12?
That's correct. This is the report I'm referring to.
You indicated that there are four equipment cabinets that are required for this facility to operate. You earlier stated the sizes of each one of them. What's the exterior appearance of these cabinets? I know you said they're going to be hidden by a fence, but what do they look like anyway?
If you peel the fencing back, they're basically a beige color. The cabinets are manufactured by Lucent. They're similar to what Sprint, AT&T, and many other carriers have. It's a very benign beige metal.
You stated earlier that two of the cabinets will be used for battery backup. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what are the other two cabinets you utilize for?
Well, those are the equipment cabinets. Those are the main cabinets with the guts of what's required to power up the equipment, to power up the antennas and make the antennas work. The radio base equipment will be in the antennas.
Are these equipment cabinets monitored remotely?
Yes, they are.
And what are they monitored for?
They're monitored for any kind of vandalism, any kind of smoke, any possible electrical wiring that's starting to have any kind of issues. They'll know right away. Any issues with the wiring will be an alert back to Metro Police.
Is that monitoring 24/7?
Yes, it is.
Does a technician need to visit this site once it's constructed?
A technician will visit the site, as you probably have heard with other carriers. They'll come in once every 30 to 45 days. They'll probably be on site for no more than an hour, probably closer to 30 minutes. Basically, all they need is a toolbox. They don't need to drive any kind of big rig or, they're basically coming in an SUV or a small car, a Saturn, whatever.
And you indicated earlier that a light is proposed here. I assume that's for the technician's use. What is that light for, and is it focused downward? Is it shielded so the neighbors won't be bothered by this?
Yes. Going back to drawing Z3, directly south of the proposed equipment, you'll see the PTC cabinet. Directly above the cabinet, we pencil in the light. That will be facing north. It will be downward. Tilted downward, and it's primarily to provide task lighting for the technicians. It will not be visible outside the compound.
And you stated earlier that it's on a twist timer?
Yes, it is.
So if a technician would forget to turn off the light, would it go off automatically?
Yes, it will.
Will the proposed site comply with all ordinance and DEP noise regulations?
Yes, it will.
Is there an emergency generator proposed at this site?
There's no emergency generator.
Excuse me, none? You said no emergency generator?
There is battery backup.
Okay.
Are any additional drainage facilities required or provided for the site?
No. There's no extra drainage. We're providing a 7x14 slab, and I believe that area already has some impervious pavement. It's basically two parking spots being taken up, so it is a paved parking lot. We're not adding to the impervious nature of this site.
Is there any additional signage proposed?
There'll be a sign put at the gate, basically, in case of emergency, contact Metro PCS type of sign, something saying, RF, but, basically the standard. Standard signage that will defer any questions, any concerns back to Metro PCS, and also warn that there's RF in the area.
I know the board has new professionals at this time from when this application was originally submitted, but I'm in receipt of the August 26, 2010 letter, which was reviewing this application. It was previously noted as B1, Board Engineer Review Letter. There are some questions that are raised in it, and I'll just go through those with you briefly. There's a comment at 2.5.1 that says, generally, towers less than 200 feet do not require registration with the FAA. However, other requirements may trigger registration. Are you aware whether the applicant, if approved at the 130-foot level, would require anything additional from the FAA?
No, they won't.
Okay. And does Metro PCS, in fact, undertake for all of its sites, whenever an extension is proposed, they contact the FAA and get an FAA certification stating that no additional lighting is required or anything of that nature?
That's correct, yes.
You've addressed the lighting, you've addressed the utilities. The applicant originally proposed a hydrogen fuel cell as backup power. Has that proposal been modified now?
Yeah, that proposal was replaced by the battery cabinets that are the traditional cabinets that have been around longer.
Okay. And as the equipment is located in a parking area, are bollards being provided around the proposed compound extension?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that point up. There's nine bollards.
Can you repeat? I couldn't hear what you said. Yes, what?
Yes, there are nine bollards that are being proposed around the fencing, around the board-on-board fencing, approximately a foot off. There'll be four along the south side and five along the east to protect this from any kind of vehicles or any issues.
I have no further questions for Mr. Thomas.
That suggestion about the cable before we... Is that cable... I forget what you call it.
Coaxial cable?
No, the...
Cable bridge.
Cable bridge, right. Thank you. Is there one already there for the existing monopole or not?
The existing shelter is basically butt right adjacent to the tower, so they didn't need to basically travel across. So no, there is not.
What is the locking mechanism for the gate?
Typically, we'll just have a combination lock.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few questions. As you indicated, you're proposing 8-foot tall board-on-board fence. The existing portion of the site includes a 8-foot chain link fence inside with a 8-foot board-on-board fence on the exterior. My experience with the cell tower applications is that typically a chain link fence is provided. Would you consider mimicking
the existing is two fences, basically a chain link.
Yeah, panel. Well, the reason why I'm asking, I wasn't here for the original application, but I suspect typically the chain link would be used for security purposes. And I suspect that the board-on-board fence was used in this facility because there is a lack of landscaping and screening from a landscaping perspective. So I suspect in lieu of the landscaping, the board-on-board was used as
If the board wants two sets of fences, the applicant will agree to it.
And I'm saying that because the ordinance does require 10% of the area to be landscaped. So, would you agree to that?
Yes.
In your structural analysis, you mentioned that the tower will hold a third carrier.
Correct.
The tower itself. But to do that, what would you need to do? You would need some more base equipment, right?
Well, that would be another application. Basically, my point was that the Paul J. Ford analysis included a third carrier for future, a possible third carrier, because I didn't want to be in front of the board saying, oh, we're okay, but not knowing the answer to what if somebody else wants. Because a lot of times when it becomes a co-location, you know, that's the kind of question you get. If you're doing this work now, if we're doing this work now, we want to make sure that we have those answers for you, and a third carrier, if ever desired, obviously coming in front of this board, would be structurally adequate to be on that tower.
Okay.
without any reinforcement.
Right. I understand that part of it. I just wanted to make sure that the full picture is played out. That to do that, you would still need to extend another base area 20 by 25 possibly.
Correct.
And the tower itself, its structural design to collapse upon itself, the monopole?
Yes. Obviously, the new section will be designed to collapse upon itself. Therefore, not extending any of the existing fall zone.
Explain what that means.
Basically, right now you have an 80-foot tower. The weak point, because it's the most stressed, is the base. If this tower was to fall over in the act of God, you'd have an 80-foot boom moving over. By us adding 50 feet, this tower will not be designed, so now you have 130-foot. It will have to be designed so that the top 50-foot will have basically a hinge where there'll be a weak point at the 80-foot level. So instead of doing this, it would do this. And then, you know. Right.
So before the base would break, the joint
correct.
Would break.
Yeah. Correct. It will still be designed to meet code requirement. Again, it's just some abnormal act of God ever comes.
Okay.
We'll have to specify for Crown Castle, who's the owner, that has to be the weak point.
Okay. I don't think that's a concern of ours, is it falling over. It's,
okay.
The reason I bring it up is because the initial use standards have certain setback requirements mm-hmm. that you have to meet. If it's a regular tower, it's 1.5 times the tower height. If it's a monopole that collapses upon itself, it's a one times the height setback. And mm-hmm. obviously this is about 50 feet from the road on one side and about 16 feet from adjacent properties on the side property line. So I just wanted to, so there are some additional use standards that need to be addressed. Mm-hmm.
You want to ask questions?
No, I'm satisfied with this. Thank you.
All right, I guess.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you very much.
We just have our planner, Mr. Masters.
Anyone in the audience have questions to the. Okay, thank you.
Swear testimony give before this hearing, be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Give your name, spell your last name, give your address, sir.
William F. Masters, Jr., M-A-S-T-E-R-S, 19 Ironwood Drive, Mars Plains, New Jersey.
Mr. Masters, can you give the board the benefit of your education, professional experience, and any licenses you may hold?
Yes, I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Landscape Architecture from Rutgers University. I'm a licensed professional planner in the state of New Jersey. I've been continuously licensed as such for the past 30 years. I was the planning director for the township of Parsippany Troy Hills up in Morris County for 13 years. Subsequent to that, for the past 17 years, I've been involved in my own private practice. Specializing in applications pertaining to wireless telecommunications facilities. I previously testified before numerous planning boards and zoning boards throughout the state of New Jersey as a professional planner, including this board.
I'll offer Mr. Masters as a licensed professional planner.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Masters, have you had an opportunity to review the zone plan and master plan of the borough?
Yes, I have.
And can you please describe to the board the zone that Metro PCS is in for the subject site, I guess the surrounds, and what is permitted in that zone?
Yes, the application that's before the board this evening is for a piece of property located on New Jersey State Highway Route 36, which is situated in the HO highway-oriented zone district. That is a zone district that is permits as its principal uses that would characteristically be situated along a major arterial highway such as Route 36, restaurants, commercial recreation, various highway-oriented type uses. Included in the highway-oriented business is as a permitted as a conditional use are wireless communications facilities pursuant to section 21-92.01A, subsection 3, conditional uses. And we are here before this board this evening seeking D use variance relief owing to the fact that we do not meet several of the conditional use requirements for a wireless communications facility in the zone district. As such, we are seeking D3 variance relief, which is a deviation or departure from a conditional use standard. The applicant's burden of proof relative to the D3 criteria for use variance relief is such that it's noted that the use has been recognized in the ordinance as a use that's permitted conditionally subject to compliance with the various conditions. The burden here is to show that the use or the site continues to be a particularly suited site for a wireless telecommunications facility, notwithstanding the deviation or departure from the conditional use standards. Specifically, we seek a variance from the minimum tower distance from property line requirement. And as your planner just noted, the ordinance requires a setback of 1.5 times the height of the tower to any property line, but it also has a provision that if the tower or tower structure is designed to collapse on itself rather than fall in one piece, the board may permit a distance to a property line of one times the height of the structure, which in this case would be 130 feet. The setback distance, existing setback distance to the existing 80-foot monopole to the side property line is 16.25 feet. So the first aspect of the D3 variance relief would be to request relief from the requirement of 100% of the tower height to the nearest property line. Again, obviously the existing tower at 80 feet encroaches within that separation or setback distance requirement. And of course, with the proposal to increase the height of the tower to 130 feet would increase or intensify that nonconformity such that the existing setback is 16.25 feet. I would note to the board that the adjacent land use to which the setback is sought is a car wash. The property adjacent or to the what would effectively be to the west of the subject property is fully developed with the car wash and impervious surfaces. The second aspect of the ordinance, the conditional use requirements, requires that the tower be painted a earth tone or sky blue color. The intent here would be to the intent here would be to maintain the existing natural steel color of the existing 80-foot monopole such that the additional 50 feet of the tower would be the exact same color as the existing monopole. The obvious reason for that would be to attempt to maintain the same consistent texture and color of the monopole, as opposed to separating or introducing an entirely different color to the pole, which would tend to draw one's attention more to the tower. The third conditional use requirement that we're seeking relief from here is the minimum lot size requirement for towers in excess of 100 feet. The minimum lot size increases from 1 acre to 3 acres. The existing lot size here is 0.638 acres, already non-conforming with regard to the existing 80-foot tower. Again, would be intensified with the increase from 80 feet to 130 feet. And the fourth deviation would be the height of the fence. The ordinance requiring a 6-foot chain link fence, and the proposal here would be to maintain the 8-foot board on board around the exterior. And as was discussed earlier, the applicant would be willing to also provide the 6-foot chain link inside the 8-foot board on board fencing.
Mr. Masters, there's also a bulk variance required with this application.
There is.
Can you just call that out, since that's the final variance that's requested?
There is also a C variance requested here for side yard setback for the equipment that was discussed by Mr. Toms. The minimum side yard setback requirement would be 10 feet, and the equipment within the proposed equipment compound expansion would be 5.14 feet from the side property line. Again, this would be the same side property line as was discussed relative to the 16.25 foot dimension to the tower, that being the westerly side property line to block 108, lot 2.02, which is currently, again, occupied by a car wash. I would suggest to the board that the application satisfies the statutory criteria required for the grant of D3 variance relief. I would note that, again, the site which is the subject of this application is a site that's particularly suited for numerous reasons. You heard from two different radio frequency engineers over the course of the two previous hearings in which testimony was presented, the September hearing, September 2010 hearing, and the March 2011 hearing, that the from a radio frequency perspective, the site meets the technical requirements for Metro PCS, and as such meets the technical requirement in terms of satisfying the coverage objective for Metro PCS for this particular area of the Highlands. Secondly, the subject site is situated proximate to major traffic corridors, which are primary generators of wireless telecommunications service. Clearly the primary roadway here in which Metro PCS is seeking to provide adequate coverage here is New Jersey State Highway Route 36, major highway commercial arterial highway which traverses the municipality. The fact that the site is situated in a non-residential zone district, the HO highway oriented zone district, the fact that that there is an existing structure, an existing 80-foot monopole at the subject site, the fact that Metro PCS proposes to co-locate by extending this existing structure on the subject site, the fact that the wireless communication facilities use is a permitted conditional use in this zone district pursuant to the Highlands Borough Wireless Communications Facilities Ordinance, are all characteristics that contribute to the particular suitability of this site, and perhaps the most important, last but not least, and perhaps the most important characteristic, at least in this particular application, is the fact that we have a willing landlord. So for all those reasons, I would suggest to the board that the site, which is the subject of this application, is a site that's particularly suited, and I believe that it continues to be particularly suited, notwithstanding the deviations or departures from the conditional use standards. I would note that Metro PCS has secured the requisite license from the Federal Communications Commission. The New Jersey Supreme Court has found that generally the issuance of an FCC license should suffice for a carrier to establish that the use serves the general welfare, and Metro PCS has secured that license from the FCC. In addition to the positive criteria, it is also the applicant's burden to satisfy the negative criteria. And the negative criteria in terms of these types of uses, again, through decisions by the New Jersey Supreme Court, has established the basis or criteria for the negative criteria analysis for wireless telecommunications facilities to be the SECA balancing test. And while the courts have stopped short of declaring these uses inherently beneficial, they have, however, utilized the SECA balancing test for the negative criteria analysis. The first step in that analysis is that the board should identify the public interest at stake. And I would submit to the board that the public interest at stake here is significant. The provision of modern state-of-the-art wireless telecommunications is a use that provides a benefit to the general public. And again, that is supported by the fact that that Metro PCS has secured the requisite license from the Federal Communications Commission. Second step in the SECA balancing test is the board should identify the detrimental effect that will ensue from the grant of the variance relief. I would remind the board that we're dealing here with a unmanned, unoccupied facility, one that is routinely visited approximately once every 4 to 6 weeks for routine maintenance purposes, and one that is continuously monitored on a 24-hour a day, 7 day a week basis from a remote monitoring facility. The primary focus from a planning perspective with regard to the issue of detrimental effect with regard to these types of uses is visual impact. And in that regard, I have prepared a couple of exhibits of photo simulations. I guess we need to mark those.
We do. We are up to A24.
There's two of them.
Oh, you have two. A24 and A25.
Are the two of us similar? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Behind it?
Yeah.
Okay. Are they both six photos?
No. A24 is six photos, A25 is four photos. A24 is a photo board consisting of six color photographs. The three photographs on the left side of A24 are photographs of the existing 80-foot monopole at the subject property, at the Stewart's property on Route 36. The corresponding photographs on the right side of A24 are computer enhanced photo simulations of the proposed Metro PCS extension and antenna installation to the existing 80-foot monopole.
And did you prepare both exhibit A24 and A25 as you're going to refer to next?
Yes. Photographs. In all instances, photographs on both exhibits were taken by myself. They were taken last year back in August the 18th of 2010. The first photograph in the upper left-hand corner of A24 is a view of the existing monopole for
from Route 36 at number 1110, Route 36, kind of diagonally across the highway. As you can see, the existing monopole in the center portion of the photograph, the corresponding photo simulation in the upper right-hand corner, showing the proposed monopole extension with the six antenna Metro PCS deployment at the top of the proposed extension. The second photograph on A24, a view of the monopole from Route 36 at Ocean Avenue, facing generally in a westerly direction. The corresponding photo simulation to the right showing the proposed Metro PCS extension. The photograph in the lower left-hand corner of A24, a view of the monopole, the existing monopole from Ocean Avenue at the intersection of Orchard Avenue and Scenic Drive, and the last photo simulation in the lower right-hand corner of the proposed extension. If the board wishes, I can pass this up. If you want to see it closer, it's your call.
I can see it.
Yeah, you did a good job.
A25. Same format as A24. In this case, we have four color photographs. Again, the photographs on the left side, existing condition, photograph on the right side, the proposed condition. Upper left-hand corner, view of the existing monopole from Navisink Avenue at its intersection with Route 36. The corresponding photo simulation in the upper right-hand corner. And in the lower left-hand corner, the view of the monopole from Ocean Avenue from the rear of the subject property at Shadow Lawn Park, the corresponding photo simulation in the lower right-hand corner.
On the top one there on A25, would you just point to the monorail?
Monopole, existing monopole, and the photograph on the left is in the center portion of the photograph in the photo simulation on the right, again, in the center portion of the photograph, almost directly between the two existing utility poles.
Do you know where the top of the new pole would be vis-a-vis the floor level at East Point?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you, but I mean, we could certainly provide you with that. Based upon the AMSL distances.
My recollection, after we can go to the bank on this, from years ago, was that the 80-foot came to the third floor.
Okay.
I don't know where on the third floor.
I recall that too, yeah.
I don't know if it was the bottom of the third floor. I just remember third floor.
Okay.
So, assuming that to be true, just for this exercise, where would that likely bring the...
About the eighth or ninth floor?
Mr. Masters, you were discussing the negative criteria and the visual impact. Having taken the time to prepare the exhibits A24 and A25, have you come to a conclusion with regard to the visual impact? And please continue with your analysis of the criteria.
Yeah, moving on to the third step in the secret balancing test, in some situations the board may reduce the detrimental effect by imposing reasonable conditions. Again, I believe that requiring the extension of the pole to be the same, maintain the same texture, design, and coloration as the existing monopole would be a reasonable condition, which would help minimize the visual impact. And in my opinion, although there obviously is visual impact here. Given the fact that there's an existing 80-foot monopole, it's a location where folks have, as a result of traveling Route 36 and in this general area, it's a location where the monopole is recognized as already existing. Clearly, there will be additional visual impact by increasing its height, but I don't believe that visual impact rises to the level of substantial impact. Requirement for the fencing is certainly a, under the third step of the CEQA balancing test, it's certainly a reasonable condition to impose on the use. The fourth and final step in the CEQA balancing test is that the board should then weigh the positive and the negative criteria and determine whether on balance the grant of the variance would cause a substantial detriment to the public good. And I would suggest to the board in considering the positive benefits of wireless telecommunications, coupled with the fact that the site, which is the subject of this application, is a site that's situated in a zone district in which these particular facilities are conditionally permitted, that the scale tips in favor of the positive. And as such, satisfies the CEQA balancing test, which balances the positive and negative criteria. Again, Metro PCS has secured the requisite license from the FCC. I believe the applicant has submitted compelling radio frequency testimony and evidence that supports the conclusion that the site is particularly suited for this proposed use and continues to be particularly suited, notwithstanding the deviations from the conditional use standards, nor does the applicant application cause substantial impairment to the comprehensive zone plan and zoning ordinance of the Borough of Highlands. I would also like to point out that while the master plan is silent with regard to wireless telecommunications facilities, I would note that the master plan reexamination report prepared by T&M Associates, signed by Mr. Truscott, dated May 2009 and adopted by this board on June 11th, 2009. On page 3, under the Borough Vision for 2020, states, the Borough continues to work with infrastructure providers to increase the Borough's attractiveness to service businesses that rely upon modern communications and data transmission infrastructure. I believe that this particular application promotes that particular goal or objective set forth in your master plan reexamination report.
You've addressed the conditional use standards and those variances. Can you briefly address the bulk variance that's requested with regard to the location of the equipment?
Yes, I think the necessity for the bulk variance is created by virtue of the location of the existing monopole, as well as the location and configuration of the existing equipment compound. The proposed extension to the existing equipment compound is a logical location and extension for that equipment, such that it integrates with the both the location of the existing monopole and does not interfere with the location of the existing Verizon wireless equipment. There is a need from a radio frequency perspective for the cabling between the ground equipment and the monopole to be proximate. In other words, the longer the cable run, the coax cable run, the greater the loss in terms of the RF. So it is there is a need from a technical perspective for the equipment to be proximate to the monopole. And again, given the location of the monopole and the layout of the existing fenced equipment compound situated essentially right at the westerly side property line, it effectively necessitates this equipment to be located where it is. And in terms of the negative criteria, again, I would point out that I don't believe that it negatively impacts the adjoining property, which again is currently utilized as a car wash.
You've discussed the uses that are permitted, including telecommunications in the HO zone. You've been present at all the hearings, have you not, Mr. Masters?
All except the March meeting. but I read the transcript.
Okay. So you're aware of the discourse between the applicant and the board with regard to East Point and the potential for locating its antennas on the East Point building, is that correct?
I am aware of that.
Have you undertaken an examination of the zone in which the East Point building sits?
Yes, the East Point condominium building is located in the MF, multifamily residence zone district.
And are telecommunications a permitted use, a permitted conditional use, or a permitted accessory use in that zone?
No, they are not.
So if the applicant were to attempt to locate its communications equipment on the East Point condominium, what relief would be required at minimum?
It would be my understanding that it would necessitate a use variance, probably of the D1 variety. At least a D2, if not a D1.
And is it your understanding that the burden on the applicant as far as its legal proofs would be more stringent with a D1 variance versus a D3 conditional use variance?
Yes, the standard of proof for a D1 variance is a stricter standard than for a D3 variance.
I have no further questions for Mr. Masters.
Any questions on the board?
I have a couple.
Okay, go ahead.
I think I misunderstood something. When you're talking about the lot size of the terrace being over 100 feet, you said it went from 1 to 3 acres. Did
correct.
You mean because of after a certain height, went was one?
Yes.
Acre
in other words, one of the conditional use standards is that for a tower height of 100 feet or less, the minimum lot area requirement is 1 acre. Okay. The existing lot is 0.6 acres, so the existing...
0.6, okay.
Right.
That answers my question.
Right.
I thought you said 1.68. That's why I didn't understand. Okay. Now it makes sense. And another question I had is, when you're talking about the, basically the reasons for the use variance, and it was proximate to major traffic corridors or whatever, where in the mix here do you put the non-motorist in terms of the access to coverage and the effect on the application? So your testimony with the, like, I'll call it a plume, the drawing, you know what I'm talking about, as to where the coverage would be.
Well, that goes to the first particular suitability characteristic of the property, in that it, based upon the extensive radio frequency testimony, the radio frequency engineers from Metro PCS have determined that the site is ideally situated from a technical perspective to meet their coverage requirements, such that while the site is situated in a non-residential zone, a highway-oriented district, in which the use is actually provided for as a permitted conditional use, and is also situated along a major traffic artery, a major traffic corridor, Route 36, it still provides coverage to the residentially zoned portions of Highlands Borough, even though it's not located in a residential zone. So I think that further amplifies the suitability of the site.
It's not going to cover all the residential areas.
Not all of it, no.
Okay.
Is there, this be 132?
Actually the very top of the antennas would be 132 feet 4 inches.
Do you have an opinion as to a height that, I mean, obviously you just keep going up and up. Is there some point where the height gets to a situation where it would not meet the positive and negative criteria?
Well, I think clearly the higher you go, the more critical it becomes in terms of the visual impact, but 100, and I think it goes a lot to what people have become accustomed to seeing as they travel the highways in New Jersey. 130-foot tall monopole is not an unusually tall monopole. It probably falls somewhere in the average range of height for monopoles.
I mean, I don't think we've heard about that. Can you give us an idea?
You get up between, I would say, between 150 and 200 feet, then it's starts to become, I think, you know, more of a concern. Well, I would sort of respectfully disagree with that.
Yeah, that's why I want to hear your response.
Interpretation. I think really the variance here is more related to the lot size, because if you look at the conditional use standard under Section 4 of the wireless ordinance, it sets forth three different levels for height. It doesn't say that you can't have a tower over 100 feet tall. It just says to you that if you are over 100 feet tall but less than 200 feet, the lot size must increase. If you then go over 200 feet, then the lot size increases again. So I think really the nature of the variance relief here is not a height variance, but really a lot area variance.
In terms of the, I heard your testimony on the particular suitability of the lot, and I'm not so sure I would reach the same conclusion as you. And in terms of, let me just lay out some other conditions, some other factors that relate to the property. It's seriously undersized in terms of the ordinance requirements, and as a result, has some setbacks. The magnitude of the setbacks is pretty different. The difference in the setbacks. Based on the size of the lot, you really can't do any screening. Now, granted, you can't screen 130 foot tower, but you can if you have a larger lot size. You can at least put some screening on the outside of the perimeter of the property to at least limit some visibility from other parts, other areas of the town. The lot is also, you mentioned that it's in a commercial zone, but it's set within, bordered by residential zones, and being the multifamily zone where the East Point's located, as well as the Shuttle Lawn mobile home park, which contains a number of mobile homes. And then in the Middletown is also a single-family residential area across from 36. And then the last characteristic of the lot and the surrounding area is the fact that if you were to co-locate, obviously everybody, I don't think the ordinance says, doesn't encourage co-location per se, but everybody wants to co-locate, everybody wants to, not only carriers, but municipalities want to push co-location because it limits the number of towers. And I think there's some, because of the size of the lot and the way it's on a developed lot, there's some limitations at the base level in terms of co-locating on the lot. So I just, with those things in mind, I mean, can you take some of those factors in mind?
Well, I would just point out that the comprehensive zone plan for Highlands Borough has determined that wireless communications facilities should be conditionally permitted in the HO, highway-oriented district. And as I look at the HO zone district, I don't see any lots that would meet the 3-acre requirement. Even assuming that the other application for this piece of property gets approved and the two properties are consolidated, it's still not going to meet a 3-acre minimum lot size requirement. And I think that logically, having not been able to work out the lease arrangements at the East Point Condominium Building, I think the next logical location is to look at where the existing monopole is in town. And I think that that's just a compelling characteristic of this property, the fact that there's already an 80-foot monopole there, that logically that would be the property to go to. The height requirements are strictly RF driven, radio frequency driven, and the radio frequency engineers have testified that the 130-foot height is the minimum height that they need in order to meet their coverage objective. So I think logically, the existing monopole site becomes the site to go to.
But as you increase the height, you're increasing your difference from the setback, the requirements for setback, and lack of screening. So in terms of how the site can really accommodate that increased height, I think it's...
Well, again, as you say, you're not going to screen a 130-foot monopole, nor are you going to screen an 80-foot monopole. And I think that the fact that you're on Route 36, given the adjacent land uses there on Route 36, again, I don't think that the encroachment into the SEPA, again, these poles are designed not to fall down. So hopefully that's not the reason for the setback requirement. I just think that the setbacks, the encroachments into the setbacks are not critical here, given the existing developed character of the surrounding area.
Can I ask a clarification question? When you mentioned the two lots,
yes,
being 3 acres,
that was
maybe I forgot this. Is this including the doghouse lot? Or is it?
No. This is not.
So that would be a third lot.
This is not including the doghouse lot.
Okay, so it's two without the doghouse.
It's one lot. It's the Stewart's Root Beer lot.
I know, but you said the two lots.
I said even if you consolidated the two lots. In other words, even if you consolidated the Stewart's lot and the doghouse lot.
Okay.
You still would not have 3 acres.
I don't really have anything further other than, you know, obviously Mr. Truscott kind of gave some overview of the comments made in the August 26th report, which really indicates that because of the increase in height, a lot of the site has to be reviewed as if it's a new application. And a lot of the variances being requested are made intensified because of the increase in height. And I think, again, if you look at the 824 and 825, it's clear that the visual impact is much greater from the increase from the 80-foot pole to the 130-foot pole. For example, in on 825, the first photos at the top, the existing tower is much lower than the adjacent building, and then with the proposed increase in height, it exceeds the height of the building from that visual vantage point. And that's consistent through both 824 and 825 that were testified to.
Could you perhaps elaborate on why there would be a need for 3 acres for a tower that tall? The 3 acres sounds like a lot of land. Something going straight up. Is it more of a safety concern?
I honestly don't know. You know, I wasn't involved in the preparation of the ordinance. certainly, as Mr. Truscott mentioned, with these types of uses, you try to provide buffering when you can. But again, the buffering is really going to generally buffer the ground equipment more than it's going to buffer the structure. And the practical dilemma here is that there are no properties in your HO zone. I don't know that even if you consolidated, I don't think if you consolidated the doghouse, Stewart's, and the car wash that you would have a 3-acre parcel.
Maybe I can try and answer. I didn't prepare the ordinance either, but I would agree with Mr. Masters. It's really a factor of having enough area to site that tower so you have some visibility. If you were along a major highway, and in this particular location, it's a triangular site, you've got two roads bordering. So if you have a highway corridor where you have a 2 to 3 or 4 acre site, a commercial site, maybe you can put it in the back, and so it's not as visible. But then you could also have some room to buffer it from any adjoining residential neighborhood or something like that. So that's, it's really a factor of that's why the area.
Okay. Any more questions?
Just clarification, maybe Mr. Truscott, on the issue for the variance needed for the beyond 100 feet or not. Mr. May in his letter said that you did need to grant the variance for that. Mr. Master says you don't. You don't. You said you didn't completely disagree with him.
Right, because the ordinance does not.
But that this is, you didn't completely disagree with him. Did you disagree with him at all?
It was a polite way of saying that. Yeah. I would agree with Mr. Masters in terms of his response. In terms of, I don't think that he needs to address that in the variance application.
Yes, please.
Okay. Jim Barlow, 16 Portland Road, Highlands. I got a question. There was some testimony before that this 50-foot extension could take more than tenants, like if there was another carrier or carriers. And I'm trying to remember how many feet up from the joint would those other antennas go if an additional carrier came.
Well, the height, again, is the heights of antennas for any carrier is driven by the requirements of the radio frequency engineers. Generally, the vertical separation between carriers for co-locations requires a minimum of 10 feet tip to tail. So in other words, from the bottom of one antenna to the top of the next antenna, usually that's not to say that you drive up the parkway, you won't see some poles in the median where the antennas are practically touching. But the desired vertical separation to prevent any type of interference between the antennas, the rule of thumb is generally 10 feet.
And those antennas, like their standard size as far as height and width?
They vary in terms of the height of the antennas. They're usually somewhere in the 4 to 4.5 foot range, but some of the antennas of some of the carriers with the 4G deployments are now up to 6 feet in height, some even a little bit taller, but again, it depends on the carrier and their technology and coverage objectives.
So I'm just trying to visualize this. You know, we're talking about visual impact. So if I could, so what you're saying is these other antennas, they would be up in here someplace,
right,
probably?
But of course, bear in mind that each time a carrier wants to put antennas on the pole, they have to come before this board for approval.
I don't have any other questions of this witness. So I have a question about what other stuff that happened to me when I get this in.
You want to talk, address to the board?
Yeah.
After we're done with the witness. Yeah. After we're done, yeah.
Okay. After.
Do you have anything, sir? Nothing? Okay. All right, I guess we're through.
I have no further witnesses.
You have no? Okay.
Now, is that their case? Does either of these gentlemen want to testify?
Well, I have a question. I've got a question, if that's okay.
If it's not, nobody wants to ask a question.
Well, I think he wants to address the board, but do you want to address the applicant?
Why don't you give me a name and address? And then we'll
I'm Jim Parlow from 16 Portland Road in Highlands. I'm still confused. And I walked in a few minutes late. Louise from East Point, was she here because of a subpoena?
She was.
And
Board issued the subpoena.
Board issued the subpoena. So you wanted her to come in to talk, right?
Well, she was the president. We wanted somebody to come and clear.
So you didn't know that the property manager was taking care of all this
correct.
Stuff.
I don't think any. I got the impression that not too many people know.
Well, I thought they knew because they were communicating with the property manager.
The board didn't have any.
Yeah, we subpoenaed Louise or a representative. Louise could have sent the property manager here today and been in compliance with the subpoena.
Because I think that's where this whole thing got a little screwed.
The board's nature of the questions had to do with whether they were interested or not, or whether negotiating or not, as opposed to just said no, because there's testimony at the very first hearing. Because as it turns out, the contact was the day after that hearing. So.
That's unfortunate. Because, I mean, the residents could be benefiting. You know, residents in East Point could be benefiting.
It doesn't make sense because it's East Point's a better location for the applicant. It's good for the people that live at East Point because there's some kind of revenue involved.
You don't have to worry about visual impact.
And the applicant doesn't have to go and build a monopole. There's a lot of things that make sense about putting it there, and the fact that we're being given the impression that somebody doesn't want it, but everybody seems to want it, but it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So it's like a curiosity.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Along those lines, there's something that bothered me about. Noelle, was that her name?
Yes.
About her testimony, and I guess you actually testified a little bit when you said that the Metro PCS would get sued by the existing landlords if this application was not approved. But, you know, that got me thinking,
not if this application isn't approved. That's incorrect.
But did you say something different and I misunderstood what you said?
Perhaps. I was being facetious in answering the question of what would happen if this...
Well, because she was making you were making a point that Metro PCS is burdened by the fact that they've been paying rent since September on one lease and since January on the other.
That's correct.
The September lease was entered into prior to your first hearing here, but got me wondering. Well, okay, how does that burden fit into they're now reinitiating the conversation with East Point sometime last fall, whether it be in September, I believe.
It was in September.
So they signed the lease in September for this property, but also then initiated another conversation. That doesn't even matter.
They did.
Right.
She's gonna take a break. We just
make sure. I know, but she would have to. She's missing testimony.
All right, let's just take this. Just take a minute. I think she'll come right back.
Anymore.
Okay, I'll take a break.
You lost everybody.
You resolve that.
Yes.
It seems to me like a conflict. It says
yes.
If you had a burden because of the existing lease that you knowingly went into prior to this hearing starting, and then you initiated another conversation, or if you got an approval here and you were able to do East Point, would the intention to be to do both, if you don't get this approval, or you get his point, will you abandon adding 52 feet to that pole?
Okay. The point inartfully trying to make earlier to the board was that Metro PCS, in reaching out to East Point, potentially exposes itself to some liability with its current landlords if it were to enter into a lease with East Point. Because they already have the existing leases going, they're paying rent on them. Despite that, because this board seemed somewhat incredulous at the first hearing where Mr. DiStefano testified that East Point had said no a year and a half prior to that first hearing. I mean, really, the impression that the applicant received from this board was that's not good enough. So it was on that basis that Metro PCS reached out to East Point, again, to confirm that they were not interested. So subsequent to that, you heard Ms. Muller's testimony that for 7 months they've been attempting unsuccessfully to negotiate a lease. Now, whether or not that has any type of legal liability for Metro PCS, that's a risk they assume, and that's not a concern of this board. You know, the concern of this board is, and obviously you have many, but the ones that I would point you to would be that ultimately, as we sit here, there is not a willing landlord. There is no lease that's been entered into with East Point. And at some point, Metro PCS has to make a decision to serve its customers under its FCC mandate and go forward with another site. Now, it started that process sometime in 2008 when East Point said no the first time. And it was Ms. Muller's testimony, contrary to the board president's testimony, that the initial negotiations dragged out for over a year. Metro PCS does not want to be put through another situation where they're dragged through lease negotiations for over a year to have the board turn over and say no. They have a mandate. They've been searching for a location for this site since 2007, according to Ms. Muller. I mean, that's really the reason that we're here before the board this evening. And I'm answering this as a way of answering a question, but also somewhat in summation, so I guess I can kind of continue along those lines. I mean, at some point, Metro PCS has to make a business decision to go forward with this application, and that's what they've done. The testimony from Ms. Muller, though sometimes disjointed, was that Metro PCS had given East Point timeline after timeline, deadline after deadline, extended this hearing before this board on four different occasions, trying to work it out, and they couldn't do it, ultimately. For whatever reason, whether it wasn't a meeting of the minds, the right people weren't talking to each other, as this board considers this application, I think it needs to consider that, number one, there is no East Point. It doesn't exist as a willing landlord. And number two, from a planning perspective, while there may be less of a visual impact on East Point, and that's, I believe, you know, what some people on the board and professionals have indicated, it requires a D1 use variance. There's no guarantee that a use variance will be granted in any application. There's case law in the state of New Jersey to support that. Mr. Master's testimony was that it's correct under a legal analysis that the burden on the applicant to have telecommunications variances granted where the use is not permitted is more difficult from a legal burden than what's before the board this evening. And the reason for that is the legislative body in the borough already determined that the subject site is particularly suited for the telecommunications use, subject to certain conditions.
You're right. There is no guarantee if you were to go with an application for a variance on East Point, but you have to take into consideration it's been done five times before with this board.
And again, I understand that, and each application must stand on its own.
It would.
And prior success is no guarantee of future success.
That is exactly the correct attitude, but we've done it five times before.
I understand that. I understand the concern. Okay.
My
Tom Kagoshian, 113 Church Street, Fairhaven. I think I heard the last testimony that there won't be a complete coverage if the tower is extended. Mm-hmm. So is there any idea? My next question to follow up to that would be, is the top of East Point giving you total coverage? Do you meet the full demand of the need at the top of East Point?
I don't think we've heard testimony that any location gives you 100% coverage.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
Yes, it does.
Okay. I would recommend, since there's nobody else to ask the question and there's no other witness to testify, that the board close the hearing and then
consistent with the discussion we had earlier, have Mr. Beck submit a memo to the board. Would 2 weeks be pressing it or not?
No.
Because if you get 2 weeks, I think at least a week before they send the packets out to the members, because it's 4 weeks.
I'll just indicate that I may not be able to refer to the transcript of this hearing for testimony within that 2 week period.
We have a couple of board members who, in order to vote, will have to listen to various tapes or discs. The exhibits are here, so they can come in and look at the exhibits. We don't have two people conflicted out. Right now, there's two. Mr. Knox wasn't here, but if he listens to it, he's heard the others, so he'll be fine. I don't know what Mr. Cervantes is going to do. He wasn't here and has missed the New Year as well, so I think we should assume for the moment that he will not be voting.
But who's conflicted out?
No one's conflicted out. Once everybody's heard everything, then everybody is eligible. Right. Well, only seven can vote, but I think you know what I mean. And then the board can deliberate at the next meeting and vote, taking into account Mr. Beck's memo and whatever I say.
But Mr. Beck might need more time.
Well, that's why I was here. To get an idea.
To get the transcript for this meeting.
When is the next?
It's the June
hearing.
2nd.
4 weeks.
June 2nd. That's what you're looking for. Okay.
10 days prior to the hearing?
That's 10 days. We like everything in board 10 days in advance. I was pressing for maybe,
2 weeks
14. That would give me, you had 2 weeks, I'd have a week type of thing. That was my thinking. I'll manage the bottom line.
I will prepare something within 2 weeks and get it to the board.
Okay. And if you want to mail to the board, email it to me. Maybe that's the easier way to do it.
Certainly, it's not a problem. Just procedurally, then the board will take a vote at the next hearing without hearing any further testimony or summations.
Once the motion is,
we're going to close the hearing. Yeah.
Okay.
But we're going to use these memos as part of our deliberations.
Yes.
But there won't be any more
summation.
Additional testimony.
No more testimony.
From anybody. But his summation on paper is still valid.
Would you prefer me to do a summation on paper, or would you mind if I briefly sum up right now?
I think we want it on paper.
On paper.
Yeah, I think it'd be better. Besides which, it'd be one less thing for them to listen to. If they could read it, might make it easier for the absent members.
Very good. I'll do a legal brief and summation.
Motion to close this hearing.
So moved.
Continue the matter until June 2 for purposes of deliberation and vote, during which Mr. Beck will supply some memo. We'll get here by the 19th.
Just for information purposes, does that require us to vote on the 2nd?
Yes.
Well,
yes, because it's included.
It's the next day, so.